The next case is 745 and 801, in P. Luttrell Administrator versus Nancy Wigglesworth. Ms. McCullum.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Jenny McCullum. Your Honor, I am being joined in this argument this morning by Steve Beckel on behalf of the Ohio Family Trial Lawyers. And I'd like to request that I reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal and allow that time to be used for Steve Beckel.
But you need to watch your time.
The most important issue that we have to remember when we are examining any issue of underinsured motorist coverage is that it was designed to close the underinsured loophole and to ensure that a person who was injured by an underinsured motorist would receive at least that amount of compensation that he would have received had he been injured by an uninsured motorist.
Ms. McCollum, are we talking about 3937-18-A2?
Yes, sir.
Are you familiar with the case of Clark versus Scarpelli?
Yes, sir, I have heard that.
Clark versus Scarpelli was argued in this court 2 months ago, almost to the day. Was the A2 issue in that case an argument?
There may have been an A2 issue in that case, Your Honor. I know the court determined in Clark versus Scarpelli that when examining the phrase, the amount available for payment to the insured.
That's A2 language.
That is A2 language, and the court held that that means and can only mean, if it is to be consistent with the purpose of the underinsured motorist statute, can only mean those amounts actually available.
That was an issue argued here as part of Clark versus Scarpelli out of the Second District's opinion.
I believe it was. I was present for the argument. What this court is being asked to do by the insurance companies today is to reopen that underinsurance loophole in cases involving situations where the tortfeasor has injured multiple claimants. To do so will utterly change definition that has been accepted by this court over the years of available for payment to the insured. With the imposition of the Central 20 Amendments, massive confusion has arisen. I've read cases from all over the state where this has been analyzed. Quite frequently, you will see the courts actually quote the limits of coverage available for payment, end quote, and say, from the tortfeasor. That is not the language of this statute. The only authority this statute gives the courts, gives anyone, is to examine that amount issued available for payment to the insured. And in fact, this is what we do in every case where you have a tortfeasor who injures a single person. We take a shorthand analysis and we say, limits to limits comparison. But what we're really looking at is, for instance, the split limits policy, the liability policy of tortfeasor. What we're looking at is, who is the insured? And what was the amount of liability coverage available for payment to that insurer? And I suggest to you that very same analysis must be followed.
Is available for payment, is that phrase have the very same meaning as payable?
No.
You know, the argument seems to boil down to available for payment is the same, should be read as amounts paid or payable.
I've seen that, Your Honor, in the analyses in these cases. And what that analysis actually results in is to say that amounts available for payment to the insured equal the total liability coverage carried by the tortfeasor. when in fact, in a situation involving multiple claims, we know that's not true.
But do we, is that our, I guess that's where we come to the, maybe a dividing point. Is that, is our role here to sort this out and decide what would be the fairer, better law, or is our role to interpret the words as written?
Your Honor, I submit that you already have interpreted the words as written. In the decision of Beagle versus Walder, I think that's the decision that you wrote, in examining the Senate Bill 20 amendment, you wrote that an insured can purchase his total amount of protection, and that if an insured purchases an underinsurance policy in the amount of $100-$300, he is guaranteed the total recovery of that amount of coverage, regardless of the status, the insurance status of the total. And I'm saying that is the fair analysis, and that's the analysis that has to be applied, whether the trophies are going to be one person or in years 10.
Ms. McCollum, given 3937.18H, all claims being rolled into a single policy limit, doesn't this issue, A2, only arise where there are multiple claimants and multiple policies?
No. No.
Why? I think it does. Tell me why not.
Well, first of all, and let me just reiterate once again, the Luttrell case does not present an issue.
Yeah, I understand. It's an A2 issue, but there are multiple policies and multiple claimants.
There is one policy that is applicable to the five occupants of the vehicle. That's the only one.
But multiple policies, that is, more multiple additional policies other than the tortfeasors.
Yes,
that's what I'm talking about. Where you have a single policy limit, one policy, the tortfeasors policy, each of them get 25,000 if there's four, let's say. All their claims can be rolled into one pursuant to H. Actually, it's another section for liability, but I'm thinking about underinsured motorist coverage. All their claims can still be rolled into, if there's one more policy, into a single policy limit, can't they?
No. Your Honor, I'll just say that can't be done in this fact scenario. We have five separately injured individuals. Section H enables the insurance companies to include terms that would collectively join the derivative claims arising out of one person's injury. It doesn't arise in this scenario because we have five separately injured.
And that's what I'm saying. Multiple claimants.
Yes.
Multiple claimants with direct injuries.
Yes.
Not the derivative claims or the consortium claims, which I think H says can all be rolled into a single policy limit.
If I understand you correctly, did you just say that the derivative claims can be rolled into a single policy limit?
Mm-hmm.
That does appear to be what Section H says. It also appears to be in conflict with the analysis that A2 commands us to perform. A2, three sentences long, repeats the phrase, be insured or and insured, at least half a dozen times. And we are commanded to compare those limits of liability coverage available for payment to the insured with the limits of the insured's own coverage. That commands us to ask, who is the insured? In this case, we have five insureds. Who is the insured? And what was the amount available for payment to that insured? When we get to the issue of a set-off, which is kind of what H is also involving, the last sentence of A2 addresses set-off issue. I always have to look at it. I've tried to memorize them all these slides. The policy limits of the underinsured motorist coverage shall be reduced by those amounts available from the policy carried by the person liable to the insured. Those amounts available in this particular phrase does not repeat to the insured, but it does say those amounts available. Which amounts? The ones previously referred to in the first sentence of A2.
I need to understand exactly what you're saying, because I think there is a difference. A tortfeasor has 100. Four people, like here, five, four people, let's say, are injured in the accident. They each get $25,000 from the tortfeasor. There is another policy, as here, that's in effect, 100, 300. They have not, the amount available for payment to each of them has been $25,000. How much are each of them entitled to access of the underinsured policy, up to what amount?
The exposure of the underinsured motorist carrier is capped at $300,000.
Why $300,000? Because of the multiple?
Because each one of those four people that you identified are individually insured by that policy. They are each insured up to $100,000. However, the fact that there are four of them doesn't increase the exposure of the underinsured motorist.
So what you're saying is that they are entitled to access up to a total of $300,000, not just up to a total of $100,000, regardless of what H says.
Yes, because you're talking about four separately injured individuals, as we have in this case. Time was very different. Your Honor, I would just like to request that the court be aware of that underinsured numbers loophole and don't reopen that. We need a clear statement from this court that the amount available for payment to the insured is the only analysis for the reaction form.
Thank you, Ms. McCullough. Mr. Bechtel, do you wish to take your time now, or?
We'll reserve.
Okay, all right. Mr. Sellins.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Sellins. I'm here on behalf of Westfield Insurance Company. I will be splitting my time with counsel for after the Allstate Insurance Company, Mr. Heather. I think it's clear in this case that the Westfield policy does not provide underinsured motorist benefits to anyone under these circumstances, because, in fact, $1.3 million was paid to the insureds who would have or who were under the Westfield policy. In this particular case, when you look at that situation, what you would have counsel for the appellants argue is that they're entitled to some kind of excess insurance, when in fact that's what statute prohibits. Under the A2 section, it does indicate that the only criteria for judging underinsured motorist coverage, not the only criteria, but the criteria is that a person who is injured will be no worse off in an underinsured situation than they would be in an uninsured situation. And in this particular case, had the tortfeasor been uninsured, these five individuals who are now claiming additional benefits would have only had $500,000 available in insurance, that is the Westfield coverage, or at least that much under the Westfield policy, as opposed to the $1.3 million that they have in this particular case, as in, with Mr. Latrell being insured as he was. And that, in essence, creates a situation in which there is no underinsurance in this setting.
Counsel, who was insured under the Westfield policy?
Who was insured? The named insured was Ina Pack Latrell. However, each of the individuals who were in the automobile, her mother, her husband, and his two children, are considered under the Westfield policy to be insured.
And the policy limits were what?
$500,000, a single limit.
And what happened to Ina Latrell?
Ina Latrell sustained serious injuries. She had a broken leg. She had significant other injuries that resulted in a period of disability and perhaps a permanent injury to her as well.
And how much did she receive from the tortfeasor? $1.2 million.
I believe it was approximately $420,000, something along that particular amount, I believe. It was in excess of $400,000.
So the dispute here as to Ina involves a claim for $80,000 or $75,000.
Yes.
Who else?
Her husband was killed. He received another, I believe, $415,000. His estate received that for the wrongful death claim.
And the dispute In his case, that would amount to $85,000.
Correct.
What?
Stella Pratt, Ina's mother. She was killed.
And her estate?
$275,000 from the tortfeasor.
So $225,000 is in dispute?
Yes.
With respect to her?
Correct. And I believe that each of the two children received $75,000 from the tortfeasor's policy.
The children being?
The
ones in the car?
Yes, they were in the car.
And is there, does that seem to fairly cover their injuries and loss, or would you agree that they may have been injured too?
Well, their actual personal injuries were not all that significant. They were treated at the hospital and released. I don't believe either of them spent any time in the hospital.
How much?
Their claim was based in point of fact, they were in the automobile for a period of time with their deceased father and their grandmother. So there was some claim under those circumstances for that.
Absolutely.
As part of their personal.
So that's a separate argument as to whether that comes.
It's a separate argument on that.
All right. But how much is in dispute with respect to the children?
Well, I don't know. That we have never really sat down and assessed whether there's anything further that should be awarded to either of the children.
Is there any dispute? There's no claim being made in excess of $500,000 altogether against your policy.
Well, no, not specifically. No, they're not claiming any more than fill up the difference between what was received, which is what was the language in the prior statute, and the limits of the Westfield policy.
And we do agree that $1.3 million was available for payment to all five claims.
That is correct. And it was paid out to all five claims. And it's interesting because the Westfield policy.
You don't argue that somebody here should have gotten more or less. You don't really dispute the allocation.
Well, Westfield didn't have any input into that allocation. There was part of some of those claims were determined in a court proceeding in the probate court with respect to the wrongful death claims. But as to whether
there's no hint of collusion or somebody putting this all together so that they can take a bigger hit on your policy.
I can't say that I have any proof of that in this particular situation. But the Westfield policy does provide, just as it relates to the statute, that with respect to any coverage provided for damages that an insured is entitled to recover, the limit of liability, which is this $500,000, is to be reduced by all sums paid. And that, in this particular case, was $1.3 million. Now, what's interesting, too, about the Westfield policy, it goes a little bit beyond what was what might be a situation in which someone could claim that they could get less from an uninsured situation as opposed to an underinsured situation, and that is by their definition of what an underinsured vehicle is. And it says that where the limit, an underinsured vehicle is one in which the bodily injury liability limit is less than the limit of liability, or where it's reduced by payments to others, and that means other than people who are actually insured under this policy. So that if you took away and paid out, if there was another car involved in this accident, and somebody made claim to that $1.3 million that wasn't part of the Westfield, being a Westfield insured, if they got more than $800,000, to that extent, there would be some underinsured motorist coverage. But here we have coverage, $800,000 more than the policy limits of the Westfield underinsured coverage. I don't think that there's any claim, and I think that the statute is clear and consistent, as is the insurance policy in this case, that prohibits any further recovery under these circumstances. And I thank you for giving some time to counsel for all states.
Thank you, Mr. Sellens. Mr. Heather.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justice. My name is Timothy Ether, and I, along with my co-counsel, Charles Hollis, represent Defendant Appellee, the Allstate Insurance Company. Certainly, I concur with what Mr. Sellens indicated, but I thought Justice Cook asked really the most important question I've heard so far today. What is our purpose here today? Are we to interpret what the legislature meant by A2 of the statute, or are we to determine what is fair? Well, fortunately, what the legislature meant is what's fair. And if I maybe give you an example that takes the example which the appellants have cited in their amicus curiae brief and add one different factor to it, I can show you how unfair it would be if we adopt their line of reasoning. Let's take the hypothetical that we have four people in a car who are driving along and they get broadsided by somebody that's got a $100,000 per person, $300,000 per accident policy. Three of these people, the innocent people in the car, are hurt bad. They each have $100,000 of uninsured motorist coverage.
Separate policies.
Yes, separate policies.
On their own.
Yes, on their own. The fourth person, not hurt real bad, he has no insurance. He got the four features carrier, he's got $100,000, $300,000. The carrier, he just wants to pay us $300,000 and walk away. The four features carrier says, hey, we're going to offer the full $300,000. We don't care how you carve it up. We just want four names on a release of all claims that releases the tort feature and releases the carrier. If we accept the argument that the appellants are making, what they can do then, they can say, okay, we got $300,000 to play with. The uninsured carrier has no ability to affect this. They can say, well, I got one guy, he's not hurt real bad, but he doesn't have any uninsured or uninsured motorist coverage. Even though he only has, say, a $25,000 worth of injuries, let's give him $100,000. That's as good as he's going to get.
Well, counsel, you're suggesting collusion there. And bad conduct on the part of the attorneys involved. That's not what we have here. Here we have a horrible tragedy. And I asked the question about the condition of this as to whether or not there appeared to be some unfairness or some setting up of an ability to make a claim that might not otherwise be made on the insurance company.
Certainly, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that any collusion or bad faith has occurred by any of these fine counsel here.
Well, let me add to that. I was just reading one of our jurisdictionals where the insurance company comes in and defends or attempts to defend against their own policyholder on behalf of the tortfeasor so that they don't have to pay out any under or uninsured motorist coverage. Is that permitted under your policies?
That I've seen that happen also, Your Honor.
Is permitted under the policy that you have?
The Allstate policy here does address that. This is a Washington policy. The Allstate insurer here.
But if that's permitted, that would knock down your argument, wouldn't it? Because you can just come in and make sure that the matter is handled fairly.
Not really, because that assumes that we're in suit. Well, I'm talking pre-suit here. The insurance companies for the uninsured here have no opportunity if we go by the amount actually recovered that they're trying to go back to that used to be in the statute before Senate Bill 20 took it out. If we go back to that old law, the uninsured here have no ability to affect that. And it does allow the opportunity to kind of allocate funds in a way that may not be fair to the uninsured carrier. And I think that's why the legislature made that change in Senate Bill 20.
You're making an argument about fairness and how this is all eminently fair. Would you agree that here the injuries far exceed the $1.3 million, the damages?
Your Honor, I really can't comment. I just looked at Ernie Pratt. That's the only guy I care about. Ernie Pratt is a young man that lives out in the state of Washington. He was 2,000 miles away when this accident happened. His grandmother, Stella Pratt, was killed in the accident. And pursuant to this court's rulings and Susan Lick and Moore, he is making a next of kin wrongful death claim. I'm really not concerned myself with the Westfield injuries. I do know there were some serious injuries. The extent of them, I've not needed to confirm myself. Urban Craft has received $8,000 so far out of that 1.3 pot. Eight grand went to him. We had no opportunity to participate in whether that's fair or allocate. And it's my belief that that's what the legislature wanted to prevent. They want insurance companies to know right when it happens what their exposure is going to be.
You're making Ernie Pratt sound like a criminal. He's just abiding by the statute, 2125. He's presumed to have suffered damage, isn't he? Does he have a right to at least claim? It may not be damage.
Grandchildren are not presumed, Your Honor. They can make a claim, but he's one step removed.
They are presumed?
They are not presumed. There's only certain categories which are presumed.
The next of kin.
Well, certain next of kin. Parents.
I want to go to your allocation problem.
Okay.
You don't have to agree to this great unfairness of giving 100 or 300,000 to the fourth person who has no uninsured motorist coverage. This is always an allocation. Every time we'd settle one of these, you sit down with the adjuster or the lawyers, and if it's a juvenile with the probate court, an allocation is agreed to, isn't it?
It is, but it's a fair allocation. And if we look
but that's,
at what,
if you agree to it,
well,
you're willing to say it's agreed to it, now it's not fair?
The carrier had no opportunity to agree or even participate in that. They're just told.
The representative sits right at the table with you.
Not on the uninsured aspect, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think that's what the legislature meant when they got rid of the old language that said, unless those amounts actually recovered, the allocation, as Your Honor suggests, and put in the new language, the last sentence of A2, reduced by those amounts available for payment.
Now, counsel, just so I can understand, you said this change the legislature meant so the insurance companies would know where they stood.
Certainly, that is one benefit.
And as I understand from your side of the table, we have an accident here. How many people injured?
I believe five.
Five
with bodily injuries.
And two of them killed.
Yes.
And the insurance companies, all of the underinsured carriers, know immediately where they stand, in your view, under the statute, which is we don't have to pay them.
Nobody.
Yes, a limits analysis. That's set forth by the first sentence of A2 as well as the last sentence of A2. It's our belief that's what the legislature meant, limits to limits. Actually, the Luttrell Court of Appeals opinion, there's several cases that espouse that theory. Luttrell, this very case, I think, is the very best analysis of it. And certainly the legislature had to do something when they made that change. And I concur with what the Court of Appeals Luttrell said. That's what they meant. Your Honor, I see the red light is on. If there's no further questions, I thank you for your courtesy.
Thank you, Mr. Heather. Mr. Bechtel, you have a little over 4 minutes.
Mr. Bechtel, before you begin, your learned co-counsel indicated, cited us to Beagle versus Walden in specific language.
Sure.
What is specific language is that?
Specific language that Justice Cook used in her opinion appears, Your Honor, on page 63 of the opinion, It is insured purchase their levels of protection. If an insured purchases uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage in the amount of 100 for accident, 300 for occurrence, the insured is guaranteed total recovery for an accident up to those policy limits, regardless of the tortfeasor's insurance status.
It's clearer than I've ever read.
The statute nowhere says that this is a limits to limits. The statute maintains the language amount available for payment to the insured. That has a meaning by this court. My colleague, Pat Murray, was here and argued that case. It's the Andrews case before this court. The statute uses the same language that appeared in that case that was determined that was the basis for the decision of the Andrews case.
As a matter of fact, the language that we looked at in Andrews, the previous language, was amount available for recovery, and then we said in Andrews, amount available for payment, and then the amendment to the statute picked up the language, amount available for payment.
That's exactly correct. So they used the same operative language that this court interpreted in Andrews, used it again when they changed the language of the statute. I want to talk, first of all, about the Allstate case. Ernie's grandson received $8,000. Ernie has a claim under Moore Sexton, okay? Ernie's underinsured motorist coverage is $25,000. Had the tortfeasor not have had any coverage and killed his grandmother, he could have gone to his underinsured motorist coverage and received $25,000. He only got eight.
Of course, Senate Bill 20 sought to overrule both Sexton and Moore in the uncodified language.
No, that was the newest legislation House Bill 263.
Yeah.
Which is not in effect.
In your case, right.
This predates it, that's correct. So under the reason and purpose, the very purpose for underinsured motorist statute that this court said, and James reiterated it, Andrews, and it's still contained in the statute, is the purpose of the mandatory offering of underinsured motorist coverage is to make sure that you're not worse off than you get hit with you get hit on uninsured motorists. Ernie Craig has got to recover. He has got to recover in order for this statute, in order for this to be valid. The Westfield case presents a different issue. You have not any...
Not so, on a minor matter, on for attorney, it's the grandson.
That's correct.
And when you say recover, you mean he's got to have an opportunity to persuade somebody the extent of his loss.
That's correct. Just
because
that's correct.
Whoever makes that determination might decide
that's
that $8,000 is enough.
That's absolutely right. But he's entitled to recover the difference between the $8,000 that he received and the $25,000.
He's entitled to a shot at that.
That's absolutely correct. And this was a summary judgment where there's no coverage at all. And that's the postulate procedure of this case. In the Westfield, as to the Westfield, all of the insurers under that case, not one of those insurers received the $500,000 limit of a comparable amount to the $500,000 limit of underinsured motorist coverage. The posture that we would take with respect to that, Your Honors, is that each of those separately injured parties would be entitled to recover the difference between what they received and the limit of underinsured motorist coverage, which would be up to the $500,000 limit. So with Stella's personal injury claim, she's got a claim for $40,000. With respect to the claim for the estate of John, the husband, it's got the difference between $415,000 that he received and $500,000. It would be collectively at no more than $500,000, the total limit of coverage. With respect to the issue of collusion, there's no collusion here. Probate courts can prove these things. I was told by Ms. McCollum that the Westfield had an opportunity to participate and declined in discussing any allocation or going into probate court contesting any allocation. I see that my time's up. Can we make one more point?
Very quickly.
Thank you. With respect to what exactly was meant by A2, Judge Peggy Bryant has a good explanation for A2. She says that the change that was made in that statute was made to account for the situation where there's exhaustion. That is, where you substantially exhaust the policy, you don't receive all of the money, that the setup that's traditionally understood that the insurance company gets is for the full amount of the limit, and not for the amount that you take less. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Bechtel. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.